You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, next week's budget and the terror of the hippo's jaws looms large. Recalling the finance minister's words during the October medium-term budget policy statement, he invoked Madiba in stating that we are fiscally at a moment not unlike that which confronted Madiba back in 1994. We must rebuild our economy, we must rehabilitate our public finances and recover from the devastation wrought upon us by COVID-19. Now, the minister could and probably should have added the devastation wrought upon us by a rapacious and corrupt ruling political elite that had sought to capture the state and subvert its development to their own benefit. But as a loyal cadre, that would be wishful thinking. The budget takes place against a much improved global backdrop, with vaccines being rolled out across the globe. And this week we saw our own vaccine rollout begin. A less unilateral world with Joe Biden at the helm of the US economy, and a more Africa-friendly World Trade Organization with its first African head, and commodities supporting tax revenues. Well, to review the week that was and preview next week's budget, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Welcome, chaps. Warwick, let's start with markets this week and the sense that the reflation trade is now omnipotent. Regime changes are hard to spot, and they only occur once every couple of decades. Rather than really a single moment, it happens over time. However, I think financial historians may look back to the 19th of January this year as a key date, won't they?
I suppose they will, Michael. I think the interesting thing that we're seeing here is that Janet Yellen is in a full-on attempt there to test drive MMT or monetary theory, and that's really where all of these stimulus checks are effectively winding up. As well, they look just like MMT, don't they?
Yeah, she was saying it's time to act big. I mean, what does that mean? Effectively, if we start to see interest rates potentially creep higher, and you've got this bazooka type spending in the US.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really what Ben Bernanke meant when he spoke about helicopter money. Well, now we really are going all out with the helicopter money idea. I mean, it's a curious experiment. I mean, if we go back in history, when was the last time that we really saw a heck of a lot of financial repression being used? And the first major scale experiment was basically to fund the Second World War. And of course, then thereafter, we did see a long period of growth. We also saw bonds yielding negative returns, in real terms, that is. The key difference now is we have a very different demographic dynamic as compared to then. I mean, in those days, they had an expanding population, improving ratios between productive and non-productive components of the economy. And now we're in the situation where we've got a substantial retirement of the same baby boomers that actually made up for the boom, or made up one of the drivers of that boom in the 50s and 60s. And it's a very different component now, yet it's also created a savings glut. And I think that savings glut is part of the component that possibly makes it easier to print money without necessarily triggering inflation and also creating the deflation into which this financial experiment is being conducted. So interesting times, Michael.
On the point that you ended there, deflation seems to be more of a worry for the Fed right now than inflation. If you look at what Jerome Powell was saying this week, and a real worry, it seems, amongst policymakers in the U.S. inside the Fed, that the U.S. Will end up like Japan.
Well, there's a couple of types of deflation, Michael. Broadly, you can call them good and bad, for lack of a better classification. Good deflation is triggered by things like growth in productivity, technology, and so on, that actively cause processes to be more efficient and drive prices down to the benefit of consumers. And bad deflation is caused by economic contraction. Now, quite clearly, we are experiencing in the developed world a combination of both. Contraction as a result of the managing or mismanaging of the COVID crisis and the COVID itself, and then, of course, technology and its inevitable march. So it's quite a mix, and it's unclear at this stage as to what the split between the two is.
And it's a very important, too, for our currency, which way we do see inflation going. And this happens, Raymond, in a week where many might have been celebrating their better half on the 14th of February this year, but we were actually celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Rand, when pounds, shillings and pence became rands and cents. What stands out for you about the currency if you look at it at the moment? I think we first pegged it or opened at about 2 rand to the pound. Could you imagine a rand at 2 rand to the pound and what that would do to our export competitiveness today? What stands out for you about this momentous occasion for the Rand?
Well, hi, Michael. Look, I think it's important to understand that the 60 years have been a very turbulent year, in fact, a period for the Rand, both from an economic and a political point of view. And I think trying to forecast the Rand has been the graveyard of many forecasters in South Africa. So I think we're all really careful. It's a highly volatile currency. It's become a highly volatile currency. It's had a splendid history in many ways. I would just make the point that although some of the calculations are showing how little you can now buy with your rand, the fact remains that over the whole period, inflation has averaged out at about 8%, of which the bulk was in the apartheid years, not in our democratic years, because since the year 2000, we've had inflation targeting, and we've been able to quite successfully bring inflation down. I think the important point here to bear in mind is, firstly, we need to be competitive as a nation, and that then gets reflected in your exchange rate, how competitive you are. And we obviously face big challenges on that front to get the fundamentals of being competitive right. The second point is, yes, it's easy to make these simple calculations about how little we can buy with our rand today. We must just bear in mind, however, that over the 60 years, we've enlarged the range and the quality of a lot of goods. So in some ways, the rand buys better things for us now. So we must be careful not to overemphasize or overinterpret what has been the loss of purchasing power over the 60 years. But I think the important point now is, in the changed circumstances in which we find ourselves, we have a flexible exchange rate. I think it's also served very much as a shock absorber for some of the external shocks that we've experienced, which have then been absorbed by the exchange rate. So I think once again, we can understand why after 60 years, when you wake up in the morning, the three key prices you want to hear about as an economist or a business person is the exchange rate, the gold price, and the oil price.
And that's why we do make a pastime of trying to forecast the Rand. It is a particular South African hobby and sport, Warwick. It's called the Rattler, though, because it is so liquid and it's so pegged to what's going on in emerging markets and sentiments towards more risky currencies, commodity-type currencies. At this time where we celebrate 60 years of the Rand, what really stands out for you?
I think what stands out for me, Michael, is notwithstanding substantial amounts of sentiment and so on that surround the Rand, is that one can actually get a relatively accurate bearing on what the Rand is doing by looking really at the inflation differential with the US then taking a view on commodities and looking at what commodity prices are actually doing. And between the two of them, those provide a very high explanatory power for the Rand over the very long term. In the short term, you do get a lot of noise coming through, and certainly quite a lot of noise would have come through at the time of, shall we say, when Favut was assassinated at times, like P.W. Botha, basically wagging his finger at everyone and not quite crossing Rubicons or whatever. And then again, at the time of Zuma and his noise, I mean, essentially, most of the time, the moves in the Rand were really pretty rational.
Raymond, this year also marks the centenary of the establishment of the Saab, which was in 1921. I'm not sure how many people are aware of that. And the one thing that the Reserve Bank has done, particularly in the democratic era, and to your earlier point, is really excelled in its core mandate, which is to fight inflation, which seems right now to really be well anchored within the middle of its target range.
Yes, indeed. And I'm hoping that perhaps later in the year we'll come back to a more in-depth appreciation of the very important role that the Reserve Bank has played in South Africa's financial history and economic history since 1921. And I think we can be very proud of the fact this is one of the institutions that is not only there after a century, but it's there doing a broadly effective job in ensuring that we have the financial stability, the economic stability, we have a monetary policy that we can discuss where certain decisions are taken. So I'm hoping that we can come back. I think June is the actual anniversary month. And I think they're also going to launch a new 5 rand coin to mark that occasion. So I'm hoping we'll come back to a deep appreciation of not only the past, the present, but the future role of monetary policy and the Reserve Bank in changed economic circumstances.
Our attention now turns to the hippo's jaws and the terror of the hippo's jaws, as I referred to them earlier. Warwick, the budget this time last year was delivered in a completely different environment. There was lots of backslapping and high fives in Parliament and the usual fanfare. And obviously this year that has completely changed thanks to COVID. Who could have foreseen what would have happened last year, February, to this economy? Considering all of the changes that we've seen, what should the finance minister deliver next week? What do you think are the important messages?
I think the most important message is going to be a cold cup of reality. As it was last year, we were already in a tight spot and skating on thin ice. And now, of course, we have partially fallen through the ice. Clearly, COVID has inflicted some terrible damage on the economy. The one bright spot was that the tax take has been a little bit better than anticipated, but I expect that probably relates to certain problems with the forecasting, and it probably boils down to segmentation as much as anything else. I mean, big chunks of the economy will have gone into loss, and I guess those losses will be out there for a long time to come. So even if there's recovery in parts of the economy, I mean, they won't be contributing much to the fiscus for quite a while. So I think what I do want to see is a clear approach from the ruling party that they understand there is a crisis. They understand that the money printing or the endless trough, shall we say, is really not available anymore, that budgets must be managed, corruption needs to be crushed, and in the meantime, what I hope to see from Tito is that they merely keep things as consistent as they can, make use of fiscal drag, and hopefully they simply roll the budget so that it's the kind of environment in which, despite the noise and distress, people can continue to believe that they can plan on a long term, not waiting for some kind of Godot or some kind of glove or shoe to drop down the line.
And the narrative is also one of a Damoclesian sword that has been hanging over our head of potential debt defaults. And we have now had the sovereign downgrades into junk. It'll be interesting to see how the ratings agencies respond. Raymond, what are you going to be looking at from the finance minister in terms of key messages?
Well, Michael, I think what's important here, just to build on what Warwick has said, I would put it in a nutshell and say this budget has to give us the biggest bang for our reform buck. That's where we are. And this means it's got to be an implementation-led budget, which will do a number of things. We know it's a complicated set of trade-offs, but nonetheless, even if you talk about consolidation or austerity or whatever you want to call it, that will not be enough. We cannot rely on fiscal consolidation to do the trick. Why do I say that? Because I think in the end, we've got to show that we can grow this economy. And so I just want to put up a couple of slides which will illustrate the fundamental that we need to get right and which this budget has to help to turn around. The first is the issue of the trend in the gross fixed capital formation, which you will see has been steadily declining since 2012. That's one chart that's important. The second is to look at the decline in fixed investment, which you will see there. It's been steadily going down in all the major categories of the private and the public sector. I want to bring in the public and the private sector here. And then thirdly, to look in particular at the public sector, both the state-owned enterprises and the public sector. That, in a nutshell, those three graphs to me tell me what is the sustainability issue that the budget has to address after it's dealt with balancing its books, looking at government spending, looking at the deficit, looking at taxes. The ultimate solution lies in growth, and those numbers are telling us what the basic message of this budget has got to be if we want to turn this economy around. We've got to see rises next year and the year after in both private and indeed public investment. Unless we do that, we'll be having the same debate in a year's time, if not in a few months' time. And that's tremendously important from my own point of view. And then finally, I think one wants to see that some of the immediate issues, such as the public, for example, the public sector wage bill, the issue of the financing and the restructuring of the state-owned enterprises, one wants to see progress. I made the point last week. We must confuse movement with action. And we need an implementation-led budget. In other words, we want to get the most bang for our reform buck. And if that's what this budget can do, it will create credibility, it will create confidence, and will also create the policy certainty that our fiscal policy can also contribute to.
And Raymond, just to build on what you were saying and to take it back to the State of the Nation Address and Warwick, to bring you in here, the President's State of the Nation Address was critiqued, but it was also praised for being a lot more focused and tightly focused around four key pillars. And amongst them was economic growth, economic reform, and the private sector front and center. So I suppose one would like to see a lot more of that expressed through the budget. And a big part of that is also to raise gross fixed capital formation. Government has got to create the conditions in which business and government can invest. And if you look just at the commodities markets at the moment, I mean, the forward consensus prices for platinum are at a discount to spot, which is a positive. And we're seeing that come through in the likes of Sibanye this week, announcing really windfall taxes and royalties for government. But the bonus points really lurk in government's actions. If it can responsibly focus on implementation instead of the Sisyphean planning and actually move forward in energy, for example, then I think we could unlock quite a lot of potential in this economy. What do you think are the key pitfalls, though, that Tito needs to avoid next week?
Michael, I think the key that needs to be avoided is government to do more directly into the economy. We need to be actually moving away from that whole developmental state model, because frankly it has not served us particularly well. We haven't seen it work very well anywhere else either. So with the exception, of course, of fixing Eskom, I mean, that's front and center is a predominantly government problem, and Obviously, the private sector can be brought in, and we want to see them brought in. The kind of obstructionist approach that we've seen to private sector generators who want to generate and contribute to the electricity grid, I mean, that kind of obstruction now needs to get out of the way. We need to have a situation that government recognizes where capital or the private sector or even individuals who want to contribute and can contribute should be allowed to contribute. And in simple words, or to quote Reagan, government needs to get out of the way where appropriate. And in the meantime, where they are getting involved, the likes of SAA and so on, well, I hope that's just a temporary wheelchair project and nothing more. And then, of course, we obviously need to be sure that wherever possible, the coronavirus vaccination project goes ahead. Obviously, we're not looking at that solving absolutely everything, but the point is that vaccination is key to the restoration of confidence. Absolutely no obstacle can be allowed to get in the way of that.
And you've got the NIDSCRAM data out this week showing that while there has been a decent bounce back in jobs, child hunger is at a 10-year high. So while children are going hungry, we're allocating capital to a failing state-owned airline, over 10 billion rand. I mean, those are the kinds of policy trade-off decisions that leave the market and investors and citizens just scratching their head as to what government's priorities are here. Raymond, just in conclusion, what are the potential pitfalls in next week's budget that you'd like Tito to avoid?
I think there are perhaps two or three of these pitfalls. The first is there is a little more fiscal space available, as we've heard, for all sorts of positive reasons. We need to capitalize on it, but we need to use that space wisely. We must stay on message. Don't depart from the basic message that we want, and that is we want job-rich growth. We want to get out of a low-growth trap without falling into a debt trap. My second point is that I think we should be prepared to look at other options. For example, I'd like to see that we do not abandon our commitment to the sale of non-strategic state assets. They can be used in a better way now in the light of the changed circumstances. So I think at the end of the day, what I'm really saying is that coming back to the fiscal plan that we need to see next week, I'm hoping that part of that will also be a structural move towards the implementation of zero-based budgeting. That's tremendously important. That will also be reassuring. But the bottom line is ultimately to produce a budget which strengthens confidence, credibility, and certainty.
And Operation Vulindlela, which I believe is going to be entering a bit of a public relations drive shortly after the budget. That was Professor Raymond Parsons and Warwick Lucas of Galileo Asset Managers giving us a preview of the big budget next week. And I think one thing is clear, the terror of the hippo's jaws is certainly going to be front and center. Will it be enough to quell the inevitable pushback that a more austere budget will generate inside cabinet? It's going to be an important test.